This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we are seeing a lot of new information on cancer in Canada and Ontario, some of it good, some of it bad. Notably, the disturbing number of people who get that terrible news that they have cancer in emergency rooms. We've heard from some patients, and now we'll get the doctor's perspective. And surgery is still a very male-dominated profession. Between 2009 and 2019, female surgeons performed only 7% of all surgeries in Ontario, and female anesthetists worked on 27% of operations. But a new study shows that Ontario hospitals with more than 35% of female surgeons and anesthesiologists had better patient outcomes, including fewer deaths in the 3 months after surgery. PEI wants to become the first province to ban the sale of cigarettes to young people. Not clear how young people, the people they're targeting, are. Lots to talk about. The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre, former head of the BC Cancer Agency and former physician-in-chief at Princess Margaret, Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and medical director of the medical station in Toronto, and Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Hello.
Hi, Libby.
Hi there.
Okay. Let's get right to it. Let's start. You just heard in Bob's News, that was a clip from the interview I just did with Dr. Eileen Davila. She's stepping down. So how did her work as the Chief Medical Officer of Health in Toronto play into what you were experiencing during the pandemic, Jamie?
Yeah, so obviously, she played a large role, especially during the COVID pandemic. It's one of those roles that are really underappreciated, because when things are going smoothly and there's no broad infections in our community or society, it's a pretty straightforward role. You know, there's no conflicts, there's no big major decisions to make within our community in terms of our public health. But her role during the last 4 years or so has been quite significant. I'm sure it's been quite stressful on her, making significant decisions on public health in our society. For example, when do you close down schools, which she did, probably appropriately so. When do you stop mask mandates in Toronto? These are large decisions that affect everyone in the society, and I'm sure it played a significant stress on her personal life as well as her professional life. So she did an excellent job during her tenure as the head of public health for Toronto, and I think she should be commended for that.
Did it make your life easier or less easy in your work?
She obviously helped all physicians in Toronto in terms of mandating certain things where we knew masks were necessary in hospital, and she helped that be a rule within our community, along with the federal and provincial leads on that. She enrolled the COVID vaccines in Toronto. She helped create the clinics with us. So I think she obviously facilitated all physicians who worked in Toronto.
Dr. Naiman, what's your take on that?
You know what's interesting, and when I reflect back on the time, I can just I can't even imagine the stress and the strain that this has placed on her. You know, when you go into public health, I guess you're always aware that there could be this once in a lifetime pandemic, and it happened during her watch. And I think she did a really good job, especially during a time when society became so far apart on their views on how we should manage things. And I can just, how it helped me was that I've told the story before, but the Wednesday before everything shut down the following week, I made the decision that I was going to close the clinic because it was unsafe. We didn't have masks. People were coming in. My staff felt unsafe. And people didn't understand. And then the following week, when everything shut down and when she made the decision to close the schools and for everything to stop and for kids not to go back to school the following week because it was March break, that it really, people then understood what we were going through, because before that, people just could not understand why I decided to close the clinic. But in terms of like the safety of everybody, we had to do it. And the stress that it placed on me, you know, having other coworkers not be able to work and not make money, hers was magnified 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, and for her to have to make these decisions, I'm sure it was quite stressful for her. And then to have the attacks that she had and people coming to her house, I can only, you know, commend her for all of the hard work that she's done, and I hope she enjoys the rest of her career and whatever she does.
Okay, I think, yeah, people have a lot of respect for her. Let's move along to the other topics. There were a lot of new numbers that we saw about cancer. A quarter of a million people approximately will get that very bad news that they have cancer. Mortality is down, and the increase in the number of people actually being diagnosed is because the population is bigger and older. But disturbing is that a lot of people are getting that news not from their family doctor, but in emergency rooms, Dr. Moore. How does that impact the work of the oncologists?
Yeah, so I'm not surprised. Sorry, I forgot the mute button. So I'm not surprised by this information. And I think Alicia probably can speak eloquently about the challenges of what I'd call the diagnostic pathway. When someone starts with a symptom which may represent cancer, they require a series of tests, perhaps opinions with specialists, scopes. The challenge is with getting all of that organized. And I have one day a week at Princess Margaret, I run a second opinion clinic where I see patients who have already been diagnosed to give another opinion about what to do. And the most striking thing I've seen over the past year is the length of time it takes from the initial symptom which suggested a cancer until the time a cancer diagnosis is made. And we're talking months here. And during those periods, the person's health declines, and obviously their outcomes are worse if they're diagnosed later. And I think what's happening is, because these things take so long, the people are getting gradually sicker, they're not unreasonably going to emergency, because in emergency they can get blood work done, they can get a CT scan, and at least then they're in the system and they can be referred to an oncologist. So I think it's another sign of what we've talked about many times, which is the stress on the system at the present time.
So is the worst part of it, from your view, that they don't have a primary care physician, or that even the family doctor can't get these tests quick enough?
In my opinion, a lot of it is they're unable to get all of the diagnostic pathway organized quickly. And in the article which came along with this, they talked about what are called these diagnostic assessment programs, where we have one for pancreatic cancer, which you know well, where the idea is that rather than rely on the family doctor to organize the blood tests, the biopsy, the CT scan, the opinion, the option, the specialty opinions, you basically refer them to a place that can expedite all of that. And the reality is that you can get all of this done in a week if you're highly organized, but it's very difficult for a family doctor in a busy practice to set all of this up and set it in motion. And I'm sure Alicia can speak to that.
Just to remind people, and I already spoke about this, that before I came to you, Malcolm, with pancreatic cancer, I was diagnosed in Emerge. I do have a great family doctor, and we were in the middle of trying to get to the bottom of what was wrong with me. Even he couldn't move up some specialty appointments. I got some tests that were not the right tests, and on it went. So the idea of a place that can organize the diagnostics, that sounds like a great idea. What's your take on this, Elisa?
Dr. Moore is completely right. So, and as you've mentioned, so there's two issues that are, I think, are driving this. One is that there's not access to primary care and people don't have a family doctor. And that will continue to get worse, as we've discussed on many shows. And so if you don't have access to care and you just go to a walk-in clinic, then it's very episodic care. You don't have that one person who's connected to you who makes sure that tests are followed up and that further tests are ordered and make sure that these tests get completed. And then you get sicker and sicker, and then you end up in Emerge. So that's one part of this problem, is that people don't have access to care. The other problem is that diagnostic imaging, since the time of the pandemic, continues to be difficult to get. And I'm specifically talking about CT scans and MRIs. I'll give you an example. I have one patient who's in her 80s who came in and told me she was losing weight. And, you know, I've run a chest x-ray, an abdominal ultrasound. We've done blood work. Nothing shows up. And now I've ordered a CT scan because I'm concerned that she has cancer. And I faxed this referral over, and it's been 2 weeks, and we haven't heard anything more. And so now my role as the family doctor is that we've now called the hospital, and we're trying to facilitate getting her this appointment for a CT scan. But I saw her this week, and I even said to her, would you even consider going to Buffalo and get the CT scan done, which is terrible. It's like absolutely terrible that somebody would have to travel outside of the country to get a CT scan done so that we can figure out what's going on with her. And then along the lines of these rapid diagnostic clinics, these pathways and these ways to access care are just absolutely amazing. It makes things so much easier from the perspective of me trying to organize things, and also, more importantly, from the patients, because when somebody is worried and we're concerned that they have cancer, to have to sit and wait months and months to get all these tests done is absolutely terrible and really not fair to the person. So, you know, there's pathways for breast cancer, there's pathways for colon cancer, for lung cancer, the pancreatic cancer, as Dr. Moore mentioned, there's like a gynecology, all of these specific pathways. And if you can access this pathway, then things get done in a very efficient one-stop shop, and people can get to their diagnosis and can get to their management further. The problem is that if you have a cancer or you have something that's unspecified and you're still trying to figure it out, then you can't access these care pathways, and then you get stuck in the inertia of the system.
That's interesting. So this is kind of the first I'm hearing about these pathways. So you know about them, and if you know what you're looking for, you can hook up with them, correct?
Correct. So I'll give you the example. Somebody has an abnormal breast screen, or they have a lump, you send them for an ultrasound in the community, a community clinic. They need to go further, and they need to have, let's say, a breast biopsy or further imaging. Most of the major hospitals within the city, and I'm talking within Toronto, that they have these rapid diagnostic centers that are created, and I fax a referral, and generally people will have a mammogram biopsy all done within a matter of 2 weeks. And then what happens is they're often connected to the a surgeon or an oncologist, where then the treatment just flows from there. They work very well. I wish that we had more, because they really do work very well.
Yeah. Dr. Spiegelman, you work in emergency. What's it like to have to deliver a cancer diagnosis in emergency?
So I come from a different perspective, obviously, than the other two. I work in a hospital where I see consults in the emergency room, and it's not uncommon for us to see a new diagnosis of cancer or other diseases that are newly diagnosed at least several times a day in our emergency room, whether it's cancer or heart failure or liver cirrhosis when a patient's alcoholic. So it's not just cancer. So there's a bigger issue at play here. So it's not just cancer. It's almost every major diagnosis we're seeing. And, you know, it's when you're the physician that just met a patient, you don't have a relationship with that person. You just met them. You're not really sure who this person is. They're not sure who you are as a physician. You're just the messenger at this point. And we have to be honest with patients, and we give them the bad news in the emergency room, and it's usually devastating to these patients that they have cancer, or they have heart failure, or they have liver failure, or whatever diagnosis we give them that's completely new to them. So it's difficult because we don't really have a relationship with this person. That being said, though, I guess I'm a little spoiled because I do work in the hospital. So if I do need a CAT scan, I could get it within an hour. If I do need an MRI, I could get it within a day. If I need an oncology opinion or a gastroenterology opinion to do a colonoscopy or surgeon opinion to do surgery, like I get it within hours within the hospital. So I feel I'm in a different position than Dr. Naiman is in her clinic, obviously. So I agree that these rapid diagnostic clinics are probably the solution to this. They have to be more efficient. I think they have to be more publicized to family physicians. In our hospital, at Humber River Hospital, we do have a two-week window when a patient does have a preliminary diagnosis of cancer to get a biopsy, to get the appropriate imaging, and to get them to the appropriate physician, whether it's a breast surgeon for breast cancer, or whether it's pancreatic cancer, to get a diagnosis with a gastroenterologist that would do a biopsy, or whether it's leukemia, lymphoma, to get them to the right hematologist. So, but it's not the easiest system to navigate if you don't know it. So even within the hospital, it's not the most straightforward. So I think we do have to do a better job in organizing this and making it a system issue.
Well, it's good for you at Humber River, but I know that even inside hospitals, sometimes it can be hard to get those slots for doctors. It can be difficult, and there can be long waits for that as well. Do you have anything to add to that, Dr. Moore?
Well, people listening might wonder, why don't we have more of these rapid diagnostic centers? The reality is that most of them are funded by a combination of ministry funding and philanthropy, because to run these centers, you need to have additional people who can track patients, make sure everything gets booked, and that's very labor-intensive. So the McCain Pancreatic Center, which I'm involved with, which we set up, could not be done without the donation from the McCain family, which allowed us to hire people to expedite all of these things and make sure the system runs efficiently. So that's the challenge, and that's why you don't see more of them at the present time, because you do require additional people to pull it off.
Yeah, and I remember when I once participated, or a couple of times participated in meetings at a patient, the thing that really gobsmacked me was that the waiting time was really impacted when someone was there to go through physician referrals every day instead of twice a week. I don't remember what the exact number was, but it cut 3 weeks off the waiting time just by doing that. And it was like, oh my goodness. Okay, I am taking a call from Barry in North York. Hi, Barry.
Good afternoon. I have a question for you. What is the effectiveness of mammography versus mammography? I know it's, from what I talk to women, I know it's a lot less painful, the thermography, but more effectiveness?
The
thermography
what?
And thermography and mammography compared the effectiveness. I the little bit of information that I have is that thermography is more effective. It's certainly a lot less painful from one of the girls that I've talked to.
I don't even know. We'll ask if they're familiar with it, but I don't even know what that is. Thanks, Barry. Does anybody know about thermography?
Yeah, thermography is not an effective screening mechanism for breast cancer. It's been around for a long time, and there's been advocates of it. But, you know, the standard approach to screening for breast cancer is really through mammography. And thermography is not a recommended test.
Okay, that shuts it down. Let's move along to this study about women in the operating room, and they make things better, and still only a very small number of surgeries are performed by women surgeons. It's a pretty male profession. Were you surprised by that study, Dr. Spiegelman?
I think that's a loaded question. It's hard to interpret the study and what it actually means. It's an it's a large observational study, so it's not a cause and effect study. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. I think when it comes down to it, it comes down to, you know, your surgeon and your team that's taking care of you as an individual rather than, you know, the whole system. You know, myself, I couldn't work in the operating room the rest of my career, so I decided not to be a surgeon myself. So it's a tough field to be in. You have to be on your feet all day long. You're operating, you're doing the same surgery over and over again. I didn't want to do that. So, and it's tough. You're on call at night. You're on call to the hospital. You're on your feet all day long. So I understand why people, whether you're female or male, don't want to become a surgeon. It's tough on your personal life. So traditionally, there are less females than males and in surgery because of that. But at the end of the day, I think when it comes down to your own care, I think it comes down to having the best surgeon possible based on merit rather than based on sex, gender, race, color of your skin, etc. I don't think that should play a role at all. I think you choose the best people to do the job. So, you know, I don't know what to entirely make of that study. Is it a realistic goal? Maybe, you know, try getting more females into surgery, but we have to be realistic on who goes into surgery in terms of career as well.
Dr. Naaman, what do you think of what he just said?
He's completely right. It's a very difficult lifestyle, and if you have a family and you have children, and still, unfortunately, a lot of childbearing and child-rearing responsibilities do fall on the female, and I think it becomes very challenging to exist within a system where, you know, you're working long hours, you're working on call, you're missing weekends, and I think some of it becomes a choice. I also think that some of it is probably related to residency positions and getting electives and all of this pathway to get where you need to go for competitive positions. And I think that if you can find, you need to find somebody who will help mentor you and help get you through to the, so that you can get into a competitive residency spot. And I think some of that is gendered. You know, I remember when I was a medical student and I was on my surgical rotations, and I always hoped that there would be a female who could mentor me and, you know, ask these questions exactly like, how do you manage having a family and being a surgeon? And it was quite fascinating that the women were actually not very helpful and were not really, did not take me under their wing and try to help and to advance a fellow female into a surgical residency spot, and who was actually much nicer and much helpful were actually the male surgeons. So it's actually quite interesting. But, you know, in my office, we have both a male and female family doctors. And I do think that there are some differences that exist in terms of the relationships that you have, and how you approach things, because it's based on your experience in life. And I think that right now that still men and women still have different experiences within the healthcare system, and I bring a lens that my male colleagues might not.
But to the finding itself, Dr. Moore, that the outcomes can be better with more women working in the operating room or more attention to detail, or do you also think a grain of salt?
I'm definitely in the grain of salt on this. I think there's all sorts of factors that weigh into outcomes, and obviously we want to understand them because we want the outcomes to be as good as we can. Again, more than half the graduating class now of doctors is women. Women have migrated into different specialties, and I certainly know from where I work, we have a lot more young women surgeons than we did even 10 and 20 years ago. So I think these changes will come, but they'll come gradually. And I would completely agree with Jamie. I didn't go into surgery, even though it looked fascinating, because I think the training program and the hours of work and the availability night and day was, I just thought was not a good fit for me. And I think a lot of women who have young families would make the same decision.
And the operating rooms are freezing cold. Just an observation. Okay. Be very curious. This study got a lot of play. I'll be very curious if that is, certainly on this panel, that seems to be the general consensus that it does not amount to very much. But there was an awful lot else to talk about this year, this week. I'm looking at the clock. We're almost out of time. And again, just to wrap things up, the actual cancer numbers, did you think they were positive because mortality was down, or big problem because of the increase in the numbers, Dr. Spiegelman?
In terms of the female cancer study?
That wasn't a cancer. In terms of just the general numbers for cancer that came out.
In terms of what?
That the numbers were up, but mortality was down.
I mean, that's not surprising. Doctors like Dr. Moore and his colleagues are getting better and better at treating cancer. I think a lot of that technology is allowing us to diagnose cancer earlier, despite being diagnosed in the emergency room for some of the cases like we talked about. So I don't think it's necessarily surprising that the mortality from cancer is down as we go along, as we're getting better to treatment. Clearly, people are getting older. Age is probably one of the major risks for cancer. So obviously, the number of cancer cases will go up with time as the population is getting older. So that's not surprising.
Okay, Dr. Moore, last 20 seconds to you on that topic.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Who can forget the screaming headlines? Eating bacon is going to kill you. Well, that's the type of spin on the research on the risks of eating ultra-processed food. Now, the most recent study, which was published in the BMJ Journal, analyzed more than 30 years' worth of data and found that eating ultra-processed foods was associated with a 4% higher risk of death by any cause and including a 9% increased risk of neurodegenerative deaths. Now, but the study and the lead author also seemed to say that some ultra-processed food was better than others, and maybe we shouldn't be that worried. So, bottom line, I'm confused. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And let's go to Rob Hobson, who is a nutritionist based out of the UK, and Mark Schatzker, who is the writer in residence at the Modern Diet and Physiology Research Center at McGill University and the author of The End of Craving. Thanks for joining us, both of you.
Hi.
Thank you.
Let's start with Mark. So what did you make of the? I really got confused by this study, but I want to know what I should understand from it. What was your bottom line on it?
Well, I think the challenge is there's been a lot of data suggesting ultra-processed foods are bad for us, and scientists are trying to figure out exactly what is it. Is it just food that comes out of a factory? There's something bad about it? Or is there something more particular? And I think in this study, they found things like saturated fat, maybe some dairy products. But that's not the only study. There's been many. One of the most famous is the one conducted by Kevin Hall, a Canadian scientist at the NIH, which found that when subjects were given ultra-processed foods versus unprocessed foods, they just ate more of the ultra-processed foods. So there seems to be something about these foods that just gets people to eat more. So scientists are trying to figure out what is it precisely that's making things go wrong.
Okay. Rob Hobson, again, the lead author of this study, I mean, they're talking about an increased risk of death and saying, well, maybe you need to relax about it. So which ultra-processed foods are the ones we have to be careful about?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that people are talking about when we're talking about addictive behaviors and things like that, are, you know, your biscuits, your ice cream, your pizza, all these kind of foods that are high in fat, you know, saturated fat, salt and sugar. But the I think the conversation has changed slightly in terms of UPFs. You know, while we know a lot of these UPFs may not be great for us because of their saturated fat, salt and sugar content, the way they're, you know, their palatability, the way they're easy to overeat, all that kind of thing. There are other foods that have fallen into that classification, things like certain breakfast cereals, high-fiber breakfast cereals, some plant-based alternatives that contain beans and pulses. Now, these don't have the typical profile of UPF, but UPF, because they've got lots of fiber and other nutrients that contribute to a healthy diet. So it is really confusing for people to understand which ones are, in brackets, good and which ones are probably less good for you. So I think that's where a lot of the confusion is stemming from, but I don't think they're all particularly bad.
Okay, well, what about... Mark, I mean, what people think about is bacon and deli meat, that kind of processed meat. That's what I think about when I think about what's bad for you.
Yeah, that's interesting because I tend to think of, probably because I wrote a book called The Dorito Effect, I tend to think of the foods that have the greatest amount of processing, where they're doing things to fundamentally change the nature of food. So they add things like flavorings, various kinds of sweeteners. These are things that never really existed in our food supply. Things I would argue that evolution didn't really design us to handle.
Okay, so you're talking about chips. What else?
I think soft drinks are a great example. You know, we often talk about, we say sugary drinks and, you know, sugar is the main villain. But if you think about it from the point of view of flavor, nutritionally, all soft drinks, the sugary ones, they're just sugary soda water. If that's what they bottled, I don't think many people would drink them. It's the flavorings that make Coca-Cola taste like Coca-Cola, that make 7-Up taste like 7-Up, that gives 7-Up that kind of lemon-lime zing. That's what makes us consume these things. And I think that's where we get into an area where foods are really becoming strange because you create this beverage that is basically filled with sugar, but you give it this zing of nutrition because it tastes like a citrus fruit, which in normal circumstances would be loaded with micronutrients, with phytochemicals and so forth. So that's where I find in food, it's really starting to become something like a sinister imitation of food.
And so are you saying that bacon is okay?
I think it's always a question of moderation. And yes, bacon is okay in moderation.
What's your view of that, Rob?
Yeah, I agree with Mark. I think food has been engineered somewhat, and it's not, you know, just as well as the flavor, it's the combination of nutrients. It's the whole food matrix that's changed. So, you know, a lot of these UPFs are very soft. They're very easy to overconsume. The ratio of fat to sugar in some of these foods is really hyperpalatable. It hits your reward centers. You're producing dopamine. They're very addictive. So, yeah, I would agree that, yeah, they have changed a lot. Some of them hardly resemble food in terms of their nutrition content and what's in them. I mean, in terms of bacon and stuff like that, that is a processed meat. And there is also research to suggest that we don't want to eat too much of those processed meats. They're linked to the risk of colorectal cancers, which is, you know, another conversation outside of just kind of what's in the food and how it affects our appetite, things like that.
I noticed that you also mentioned ice cream. Now, a lot of us buy ice cream, but you can make ice cream with perfectly natural products, dairy products, that I wouldn't think are particularly bad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big ambassador of cooking your food from scratch, and I did write a book called Unprocessed Your Life, which is all about showing people how they can make homemade versions of many of these ultra-processed foods. The problem is, it's not that it's bad, it's the fact that it's very easy to overeat them. You know, the taste, the palatability, they're very addictive foods. So, and people that are more predisposed to addictive behaviors, you might genetically have a slightly bigger appetite because of the hormones, your hunger hormones and satiety hormones in your body. So for those people especially, it can be a nightmare because, you know, you can just keep eating these foods and not feel full. And, you know, that increases your risk of putting on weight, becoming obese, which underlies many chronic diseases. So It's much bigger than just, you know, kind of what's potentially in that food as such.
It's also, you know, ice cream is particularly interesting because you can make ice cream at home, and typically you make it with very simple ingredients. You might get frightened because there's a lot of cream, but look at the ingredient labels on the ice creams you find in the supermarket. They're loaded with all sorts of bizarre additives. Fat replacers are a big one. And one of the reasons they do this is they want to bring the calorie count down because everybody's looking at calories. But there's so little research that's been done on these fat replacers, which are additives that create the experience of fatty food but deliver no calories. Now, one of the concerns is that this fools the brain. And when the brain gets fooled, it says, well, next time I'm not going to get fooled. It goads us into eating more. So this is another great example of foods that you make at home really are in so many ways different than the foods that are manufactured in terms of complexity and just, I mean, where would you even find, look at these ingredient lists, where would you even find them? How would you go about attempting to make that at home?
I wouldn't have thought that ice cream was a problem. I've taken to eating it lately. I guess I have to get the churn out.
Look, for example, at Italians. They insist that their gelato be made with simple and pure ingredients. The serving is always small, and yet somehow it's satisfying. You know, Italians, they take pride in their gelato.
It's not so always many... so small. Like in the shops here, you can get 2 and 3 scoops. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
No, but that's it exactly. Their food is so richly delicious, but also satisfying. And I think part of the problem is that so many of these additives, they don't really satisfy us the way that what I would call real food does. And I think that's where we get into difficulty.
Yeah,
so,
and I think
we become frightened of pleasure. And I think that's part of the problem because real food actually is delicious and it is also satisfying.
Yeah, I think you also touched on a really good point, Mark, as well about the portion sizes. You know, this food, the UPF food, is quite aggressively marketed to people. It's brightly coloured. It does come in big portion sizes, you know, big packets of crisps, big packets of sweets. And, you know, I think that's part of the problem is access to this convenient food. And one of the reasons people are overeating is because it's just there and it's in a big serving size. So it's hard to turn it down.
Yeah, you have to look when you get a big bag of chips and you look on the back, they say a serving size is 10 chips or something.
Yeah,
I don't think people pay attention to that. So let's move to the bottom line as we wrap things up. So, Mark, what do you hope people will take away from this latest study?
I would think just to be suspect of, you know, the way food is made, instead of being focused on calories and things like that, just think how much technology went into making this and could I make this at home? I think I would encourage people not to be afraid of food, but just eat real food and indulge yourself and enjoy it. But it's the highly confected, high-tech stuff that in general seems to get us into trouble.
Okay. And Rob, what's your bottom line on this study?
Yeah, definitely. I think whole foods all the way. But I think for the consumer, I think they need to get wise. They need to understand what to look for on the label, how to see through marketing and health claims. And just getting to grips with understanding kind of what's going into this food and how they can make better choices.
Okay, thank you so much, Rob Hobson and Mark Schatzker. Appreciate that. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks. Cheers.
Okay, we're taking another break now, people. It's back. Sankofa Square. This is an issue that really upset a lot of people, but the renaming seems to be on when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Okay, everybody, take a deep breath because our next segment is something most of us get really annoyed about, and that is the renaming of Yonge Dundas Square to the Ghanaian concept, Sankofa Square. People, it's on. Now, apparently, Google Maps is already showing the square as Sankofa Square. And the city has said it intends to formally get rid of the Dundas name from the square by the second quarter of this year. And we are now in the second quarter of this year. And it plans to rechristen the Dundas West and Dundas subway stations and the Jane Dundas Public Library afterwards. And as if we need reminding, who's paying for this? We're, of course, learning that we're going to be spending this millions, just as we're hearing that Toronto is billions. That's billions with a B short for actually necessary repair projects. Makes you wonder about priorities. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Toronto Councillor Brett Bradford of Ward 19, Beaches East York, and Daniel Tate, concerned citizen, taxpayer, and co-organizer of an online petition to reverse the name change of Yonge Dundas Square. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Liv.
Councillor Bradford, as far as you know, how far along is the project? We just saw the square on Google Maps noted as Sankofa Square, but is the rest of it in progress?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you on that. I mean, for all the things that the city consults forever on, this was something that the mayor decided to ram through with no warning to the public or even the members of the advisory committee who were actually brought together to come up with a short list to vote on. And so the communication on this file has been zero. Certainly my council colleagues, the ones that I've spoken to, haven't heard much more on this. But we know that, you know, if they are moving forward with it, there's a lot of things that they're going to have to get lined up. Big and principally, number one, of course, would be the funding. And I think you teed it up pretty eloquently there, Libby. When we're dealing with a $26 billion capital backlog over the next 10 years, any money that is diverted to things like this, it does call into question the priorities of the mayor and the administration and what we're actually focusing our time and our energy and our dollars on.
It seems to me, and Daniel, I want your take on this, that I spoke with Chris Moisey, who is the driving force of this, and he said that he's got the money and it's from that fund that developers pay when they want to put up a building or whatever it is to make improvements alongside their developments. So before we move to Daniel, Councillor Bradford, does that mean he would have more control over that money and it wouldn't be in a general pot?
Well, you know, there's some truth to that. This would be what was called Section 37 in the Planning Act. Those were dollars under the previous system that were allocated for community benefit and try and offset some of the impacts with additional density. So if a developer comes in for an application that has a lot more density than was anticipated, there was a Section 37 contribution. But those are for community benefits. And, you know, I wonder if a lot of folks in that neighborhood, given all the challenges that they're dealing with, you know, encampments and some of the safe consumption sites and all those sort of things, if they feel like the community benefit is spending $1 million or whatever on renaming Yonge Dundas Square. I'm not sure if that's the best use, but councillors do have, when they have Section 37 dollars available, they do have some discretion over where those dollars are used, but typically in the agreements, it's actually spelled out and it's specified. So, you know, I don't know if renaming Yonge and Dundas Square was articulated or specified when those agreements were struck. I wouldn't have access to that type of information. But again, I would just say most people are probably out there shaking their heads on this one. The idea that this came out of nowhere, was walked onto the floor of council a number of months ago, to the surprise even of the advisory committee that was involved in it. And as Daniel will point out, it's a cascading effect. It starts with Yonge Dundas Square, but now we're unilaterally renaming TTC stations and libraries as well. And, you know, I think we've kind of lost the plot on this one.
Daniel?
I fully agree. Citizens are still really upset, up in arms about this. You know, myself included, our petition is still alive and well. We're very close to 30,000 signatures. And so just to your listeners, if anybody hasn't signed the petition, please do so. It's change.org/SaveDundas. And we do intend to deliver this petition to the city a lot of people are just really upset about this, and we need to send a message that the nonsense needs to stop.
It's, again, not clear about how you stop the nonsense. It's again, kind of a mystery. You know, Olivia Chow, for the most part, has been governing in a practical way, and then there are these sudden bursts of ideology. Councillor Bradford, do you have an explanation?
I think that's a better question for her. But what I will say is there are moments where you see, compromise and collaboration. And I think that's frankly what people want to see more of. But then there are things where, you know, you ram through a nearly double-digit tax increase, or on the floor you're walking on a motion to rename Yonge Dundas Square, or you're trying to impose an illegal unilateral cap on Uber licenses. Like, there has been a number of things that has taken place over the past year that probably is more in line with what people would have assumed you'd get with a sort of left-wing ideological mayor. And then there's been moments of collaboration. So this is one of them for sure. And I think, you know, Daniel and the initiative of trying to give residents an outlet to say stop the nonsense, you know, he's got nearly 30,000 signatures, and I hope listeners will sign it at change.org. But if you remember the original petition that kind of got us into this mess, a number of years back, I think it was 13 or 14,000 signatures.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, so this is, yeah. So again, I think we've gone too far. We've left Torontonians behind. We're going to have a big bill to pay for it. And it's just a waste of time and energy and resources on something that, you know, very few people are actually looking for.
Okay, let's hear from Simone in Parkdale. Hi, Simone.
Hi there. Yeah, Chow's leftist social engineering clause are showing that we have, look at the problems with social housing, the conditions, and then she's not even talking about that. And, you know, Chris Moisey is the one who's determined to have this done. He talks about slavery. They're trying to present the candidates as the old South, the American South. And so they're using this as an excuse. And Dundas the stations and things, and this is, we know these stations where they are by their name, and it's ridiculous to change the name.
Okay, thank you for that, thank Simone. You. Let's go to Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got a few quick points. I will never use the term. Secondly, as I understand from before, that it has to do with going back and reflecting upon things and then trying to get them right. So when we get rid of Olivia Chow in the next election, we'll be able to do just that, and this will get changed around. The other thing is, who are the developers that paid the money, and how do they feel about this?
That's a good question.
You know, I mean, this is not what they put their money to. I'm pretty sure of that. And we should advertise their names associated with it and see how they feel and what kind of pressure they can get up with. And one other thing I want to point out, one of your panelists, when talking about this months ago, Paula Fletcher, actually had the nerve to say, well, we saved you $12 million by not renaming Dundas Street. So for the amount of money that they've wasted on this, it's just, it's absurd. And I encourage everyone, don't use the term. We don't have to adopt it. It's not ours. And as I say, when we change the mayor, we'll change it back.
Okay, thank you for that. I want to get back with Councillor Bradford. So can you figure out where this is at?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to look into it, but I can tell you there's not a lot of appetite from my colleagues to explore this again. I know that Daniel's had conversations with folks, and there's a number of us down there at City Hall that are very frustrated, but I actually tried to reopen this with a vote at council to have a better, more informed debate on it, and you know, the majority of councillors voted against that opportunity to discuss this further. So, you know, absent the continued public pressure, and Daniel and folks have done a great job of that, but it is going to be difficult to kind of have that conversation on the floor of council, because you have to move a motion to reopen the debate, and that requires a two-third majority of council to approve that, and right now the votes are not there for that.
Right, but I mean, figuring it out, are they actually moving ahead with it, or waiting? Is it stuck in some bureaucratic thing, or has Mr. Moisey maybe decided that this is not a good time to move ahead with it? I just, Is it in motion? To what extent is it in motion?
We should follow up with the relevant divisions, and you know, and I'll make a point of doing that and just try and get some clarity. I think it'll be better if I go through the bureaucrats and the staff at City Hall. They would probably be more transparent than the political angle of this, because I think they're trying to duck and cover on it right now. And again, set against a backdrop of a record-breaking tax hike that the mayor's thrust upon everyone here in Toronto and a $26 billion capital backlog, you know, the administration and council is pretty stupid driving this forward right now.
Okay, well, yeah, I don't know if that's going to stop them. Daniel, what are your plans to see if there's any kind of 11th-hour solution?
Well, you know, as Brad mentioned, I'll leave it to him and other city councillors to you know, manage any levers politically to bring this back front and center with city council. But from the citizen point of view, we're certainly going to be registering, formally getting it on the books, this petition with the city. Any way that this petition can be utilized for, you know, amongst the bureaucracy or political levers, we'll do that. And then if and when there is a sign change ceremony, which I imagine Chris Moyse and Olivia Chow will announce with pomp and circumstance, then we should definitely put a call to all concerned citizens across the city to go down there during that ceremony, rally, and let them know that this is not acceptable.
Okay, well, that would be an interesting protest. Thanks so much for that. We're out of time for today. Thanks so much, Brad Bradford and Daniel Tate. And as I said, we will be talking about this with our municipal panel tomorrow, and that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.